Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Greetings. You're listening to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Christians for Liberty Network. I'm Cody Cook, and today I'm sharing a conversation that I had on fellow CFLN host Jacob Winograd's Biblical Anarchy podcast. Since not all LCP listeners subscribe to the Biblical Anarchy podcast, though you should, I wanted to make sure you guys were able to hear this conversation because it's a subject that's close to my heart, and I think we covered a lot of important ground. Jacob provocatively titled this episode, Make Racism Great Again? You notice the uptick, the question mark there? Which could suggest that we're going after Trump, but that's not exactly true. It was really a conversation about elements within the libertarian movement who are either supporting or excusing ethno-nationalist sentiments. This concerns me not only as a libertarian, but also as a Christian, and you'll hear exactly why. I hope you enjoy this conversation and think it's as useful as I do.
All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Biblical Anarchy Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and part of the Christians for Liberty Network. I am your host, Jacob Winograd. Conversation I have for you guys tonight is a subject that I've been wrestling with for a while, and I've been wanting to talk to people about this for a while, and that's why you have a guest on the Biblical Anarchy Podcast as opposed to just this being done on the green room or just my regular solo episodes. But I think we're at a weird point in the liberty movement, at least as far as I can tell for as long as I've been in it. And as also I'd say, you know, we as the church, right, we as Christians are, you know, evaluating what's going on in our nation and the world. It's definitely a bit of a crossroads, a tipping point, you know, a lot of different cliche analogies we could use. But I think we have to ask hard questions about, you know, dealing with the world as we want it, balancing that with dealing with the world as it is. And you know, we talk a lot about this in libertarian circles, you know, and rightly so. We talk about our principles, right? Our legal theory, our economic theories, and our commitment to those abstract principles, I think is good and important. You know, we believe in non-aggression. We believe in peace and in freedom and prosperity, self-determination, self-ownership. And those are all good things that need to be talked about. But the question that's increasingly on my mind is how do these ideas hold up in a society that feels increasingly fragmented, increasingly tribal, very chaotic and unstable, and just seems to hate liberty, right? And even sometimes, you know, seems to be very anti-Christ. It even seems a lot of times people who call themselves Christians seem to hate when you quote scripture to them. And so I'm just wondering, you know, is the liberty movement still building towards liberty, or are we watching, you know, liberty unravel in real time? And there's this phrase that's been floating around in the political discourse that I've heard Dave Smith and a few others use. I don't know where it originates, but I think it kind of cuts to the heart of some of the convergence of a few different topics of discussion. But this idea of bomb the world, invite the world. There's a bomb the world, invite the world agenda. It's a provocative way of describing this sort of dual role that America is playing, where we're waging endless wars abroad while opening up borders at home, or at least somewhat opening them up or failing to, you know, close them. I'm not trying to oversimplify it, but there's an immigration crisis, right? Like, as much as we don't have open borders, we do have, you know, large influx of illegal immigrants nonetheless. And these things seem to be connected, right? Insofar as the endless wars cause destabilization, as well as the intelligence agencies play a role in this. And for those who oppose empire, such as, you know, us libertarians and Christians who believe in peace and voluntary association, you know, I think we have to ask, are we, you know, when we're talking about the topic of immigration, is it just, you know, that topic by itself, or is this really just kind of like one outward manifestation of a deeper, multifaceted problem? A framework that's going to be part of what we talk about tonight is an article But actually, I think the transcript of a speech that Jeff Deist from the Mises Institute gave years ago, back in 2017, I think before I was even a libertarian at this point. But he said that many people in the West still care about blood and soil and family and their nations. And, you know, not just because they're racists, but because identity, family, and just where people live, that these things matter to people. And he said that if libertarians ignore this reality, we're doing that at our own peril, that we're making the movement too theoretical and too detached from real world issues and sort of like what people are concerned about. So my last live stream in the green room was with Jim Babka. We touched on this a little bit, but I thought that a good person to help me work some of this out, because I've been, kind of going back and forth with how I view a lot of these topics for a while, is Cody Cook, which everyone should know from the Libertarian Christian Institute, and also has his own project called Cantus Firmus. He's the author of The Anarchist Anabaptist, and I know he has also like a little Anabaptist handbook, and has written all sorts of stuff, is also a co-host on the Libertarian Christians podcast. But we're going to explore all this. If the liberty movement can survive this growing tribalism, if we can have open borders and a functioning republic, can we, do we have to return to, more localized, nations and something quasi self-governance before we can dream of voluntarism? And then what does our faith say about all this? So that's the stage for this conversation. And I'm going to bring Cody up now so we can dive into it. Cody, thank you for being here with me tonight. We're recording this at night, as we often do. But yeah, it's good to see you, my friend. You are like the I don't know, what's the term for, I guess, like you're the quarterly guest of the Biblical Anarchy podcast now.
I think that would be the quarterly guest of the Biblical Anarchy podcast, I think is what you'd call that.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So, a perennial.
Perennial. I was looking for, yes, that's what I was looking for, the like what ends in like, the perennial. Yeah, that's the right word.
Maybe not a favorite, but a perennial something. Perennial guest.
Yes. So, right. Cody, I gave a long intro monologue there, and it's one of these things where it's hard to, I think, really pin down, like, here's the, like, I think a lot of episodes we do will be like, we're talking about the Constitution, or we're talking about economics, or we're talking about the war in Israel or Ukraine. This is something where it's like a lot is happening all at once, and it's hard to say like what the theme is. But do you at least, and I'm sure we're going to have a lot of stuff here we agree on, a lot of stuff where I hope we disagree enough at least that it'll make for good dialogue. But do you agree with me that this is somewhat of the like the central themes and tensions and problems that we as a society and also the liberty movement is kind of having to figure out right now, especially post-Trump 2.0?
Yeah. I was thinking about, like you mentioned, like Trent, what's the organizing idea here? If I were to maybe suggest the title, it might be something like, how big is libertarianism? Because when I think about what these kind of debates are about, I think it's largely about, it's not just about evangelism. I think it's more about like, because I understand sort of saying like, well, if we are speaking to people on the right, we emphasize this part of what we believe. If we speak to people on the left, we emphasize this part of what we believe. And then we try to kind of bring them in and expand it. And to me, I think what I've been seeing is more kind of a conversation about, I think, redefining libertarianism along the kind of culture war concerns and identity politics. And so questions about immigration, questions about racism, nationalism are sort of coming into this conversation, because it's like, on the one hand, as libertarians, it seems like individualism and sort of a fundamental equality, although I know that we would, a word like egalitarianism can be read in different ways, and some libertarians just don't like the word. But like, that tends to suggest a kind of neutrality about things like race and ethnicity and nationality and stuff like that. But there are some who I think want to emphasize another part of libertarianism, which is kind of the live and let live side. And so then it sort of becomes, well, do we really have to have an opinion on a subject like that? Isn't it okay for, if a bunch of racists want to start a community or whatever, to let them do it, right? And isn't that compatible with libertarianism? And so, I think we're kind of having this conversation largely about, you know, I think it's kind of the paleo thing again. It's like, can we make room for people on the right who are maybe a little bit disaffected, who maybe see that the system is bad like we do, and maybe they think it's bad for different reasons, but there's maybe a little bit of overlap there, and we can sort of bring them in and but also make them feel like they have a safe place to land, that this is not, you know, some kind of weird cosmopolitan internationalist, you know, kind of thing. And so I think that's kind of really what this debate is about, is do libertarians need to take a strong position on open borders or being against racism? I almost said anti-racism, but that's another one of those words that means different things to different people. Or is it, can we let a million flowers bloom? And is, you know, is it more libertarian to let a million flowers bloom? Or is it more libertarian to say, as libertarians, we believe in the individual dignity and value of each human being? And so I think that's to me, I think that's maybe what the larger part of this conversation is. You know, and I won't repeat myself or pontificate more about that. Maybe we can go from there. But that's what I'm seeing.
Yeah, I'm of two minds of this, because on one hand, I've generally, I guess, been more in the what people would call paleo libertarian camp, but that even for me wasn't something about like, well, I want to recruit racists and tell them it's okay to be racist. It's more just like, you know, things like racism, things like prejudices, you know, these things exist on a somewhat of a spectrum. And then, you know, there's things that are related to it, like, you know, immigration policies, protectionism, nationalism. And I think, you know, I've always kind of had, I guess, two tracks in my, you know, sort of libertarian, ANCAP, biblical, you know, anarchy message, which is that I want to have one foot firmly entrenched in the foundational principles, because I do think they're important. And I think no matter how you're going to act in the world, you need to, you know, have that North Star to guide you. But I also felt like, but the North Star should guide you. Like, you shouldn't just be like, sitting in one place, gazing up at the North Star, going, "Man, it's such a good navigator, but I'm not gonna follow it. You know, I'm not gonna use it to help me get to where I want to go." And it's like, so I do want to see a society that is not just more, you know, obviously, I, you know, as a Christian, I want to evangelize, want more people to come to saving faith. I also want to see a society where there's more peace, more human flourishing, more social cooperation, less violence, less aggression, and, you know, how do we get there is the question. And it does seem like, you know, I guess this would be my question to you. Do you feel like, this is how I feel, that no one has a good answer to this? It feels like one side says, well, it's about education. It's about being committed to our principles, which, like, I agree that's like an important step one, but the step two is sort of like, well, we don't really have a step two. It's just that'll eventually, you know, get us there. Then there's a lot of people who have a step two, but their step twos are kind of like, we're seeing that play out and it has mixed results, right? You know, I think before the Mises Caucus, there was like, well, the step two is we're going to really appeal to, you know, the coastal elites and, you know, sort of this, like, you know, sort of liberal progressive establishment and, you know, go hard on the social issues and whatnot and almost try to trick them into being libertarians. And, you know, that didn't pan out. And now it seems like we've kind of, I guess, for better or worse, had a experiment the other direction that's almost like a, not exactly the paleo strategy 2.0, but you could call it that. And I would say that I, you know, a year ago, heck, even was it, we're in May right now, so like 5 months ago, even 2 months ago, I was like, you know, still like various degrees of optimistic about how that could go. But now I've seen that play out more and I'm starting to be like, I don't know that this tree is producing good fruit, because it feels like, you know, to put it the way you put it, can we get these people to come to us and feel like this is a safe landing spot? Kind of feel like the opposite is happening. And there are libertarians who are finding like, yeah, maybe the liberty movement is not, you know, the best landing spot for me. And, you know, maybe I need to smuggle in a little bit of statism and tribalism and stuff. And
yeah.
And that's the path forward.
Yeah. Yeah. When I think that the question I think becomes what's at the center of libertarianism. And for me, there's some documents here we should bring up in a minute, things that we've been kind of debating about, because you use the word optimism earlier for yourself, And some of our kind of private debates have been about, I think, you being more optimistic about kind of this sort of appeal to the populist right and maybe what Trump could bring in. And you're like, these people aren't all just racists and anti-Semites. And I've been like, yeah, they are. And so, and now you're like, okay, maybe more of them more than I thought.
Right.
And so to me, when you talk about strategy, we'll mention, I'm sure, Rothbard and Jeff Deist and some of these folks, but, you know, like Deist kind of argues that libertarianism, really the center of libertarianism, is decentralization. And I would say it's not. I mean, it's compatible with it, but it's not the same thing. And Rothbard sort of argues that the center of libertarianism is privatization. And I'm like, well, no, it's not really the center, but it's also compatible with it. For me, it's kind of like what you said earlier. It's about the freedom for individuals to live in a voluntary society that respects their rights as individuals. It's about peace. It's about working together. It's about cooperation.
Right.
And so I think that's really what we're trying to get to. And what some would sort of say is, well, if we start with decentralization, we'll probably get there. Or if we start with privatization, we'll probably get there, right? Like David Friedman, the son of Milton Friedman, is an anarchist. I watched a video of his recently where he was sort of saying, like, you know, yeah, let's just start with privatization and it will probably make a more libertarian society. It might not, but it probably will. And say, well, that's not good enough for me because that's not really what the center of it is for me. You know, privatization is great, but it's not the center of it. And so if you have a solution that doesn't really get us there, I don't really see that as a solution, you know? And so anyway, we'll maybe we can talk a little bit about these kind of different approaches, but to me, I think that's part of the problem. And we'll get into why I don't think decentralization is the right solution.
So I would agree with you that decentralization is not the heart of libertarianism. I think decentralization is a feature of a libertarian society. I think it's a good strategy in terms of like trying to decentralize is generally better than, I guess, the opposite. Like, you know, it's generally not good to centralize. But I've even said, you know, to play, I hate using the term devil's advocate, play angel's advocate, I don't know. But to play an advocate for a contrary position, you could say that there are times in history where centralizing power, although it had its trade-offs, good things did come about it. Like, as much as I am sympathetic to, I guess, like the more paleo libertarian wing having very, and even just the regular libertarian wing, I think, having legitimate criticisms for Abraham Lincoln and sort of the centralization of power and suspension of certain constitutional norms during the Civil War, and also just being anti-war and not wanting a war in the first place, right? And there's a lot of centralization and authoritarianism that happened, but it would also be, I think, overly reductionist to say like nothing good happened out of that mess, right? Like there was some, in terms of like the progress of society, broadly speaking, in terms of how we view minorities, how we view different races, how we view slavery, like that was like the worst possible way to take a step forward. But it was, for all of the bad, I think there was a step forward to be analyzed there. And I'm sure you would probably, you might articulate it differently, but I think you would mostly agree with that kind of couching of it. But we would much prefer if we could have like had the good stuff without all the bad, right? Like generally we want to pursue the moral progress through decentralization. You have something to say. You can chime in quick before I get to my next bit.
Well, yeah, I mean with decentralization, I think that there's an assumption that decentralization is a step closer to individualism, right? So if you have this kind of big centralized power, and now we say, okay, well, we're still centralized, but it's on a smaller scale, well, that's an improvement, right? We're getting closer to the sovereign individual, right? And so, you know, Jeff Deist, the Mises Institute, in his article for A New Libertarian, which you peeped me to, he argues that libertarians expect basically that our universal principles must work out through a universal political arrangement. He says that that's kind of a problem with libertarianism, that we that of a certain kind of libertarianism.
Sure.
And that libertarians sort of feel like no matter where you go in the world, if it's a libertarian world, it'll look pretty much the same. You know, women will have equal rights to men, black and white people will be treated the same, et cetera. And Deist argues really that libertarians shouldn't actually want a world that looks that way, or shouldn't try for a world that looks that way. And here again, I have an agreement and a criticism. Like, I agree that cultures and societies and subcultures will look different. But if we're talking about a truly libertarian society, it's not going to kill gay people just for being gay, right? I don't think, you know, yes, we've created a Sharia law, but it's look how much smaller it is. Like, that's libertarian, right? And so, like, you know, decentralization is good, but it's not the same thing as libertarianism. If we got rid of Washington, D.C., and then half of America became significantly less free as a result of it, I wouldn't cheer that on, right? Well, it's authoritarianism, but it's at a lower level, right?
Right. And just so, like, you know, just to use my example as a you know, piggyback, like, if we were to say that, like, the North lost a civil war and it was, like, cool, so there was a successful secession and a breaking up of a country, right, and it's like, we could say, all right, but that other country is still, like, practicing slavery, so, like, we're not big fans of that.
We're like, look, North Korea seceded from South Korea. Isn't that a more libertarian solution? And so, you know, the thing about libertarians are, you know, we tend to be in that third way space, right? So we look at the Civil War and we say, you had Southerners who wanted to enslave people, or at least a proportion of the Southerners did, and then the power structure did. And then you had the North that basically said, you know, you don't have a right to secede. You don't have a right of individualism. And so we look at them both and we say, these are both bad. These are both, like, you know, rotten fruit that emerges from a tree of authoritarianism. And so, whereas, you know, people who are kind of on the far right or the left would look at it differently. They'd say, well, you know, Lincoln was right because he wanted to free the slaves, or the South was right because they wanted to do what they wanted to do. And, you know, who cares? Black people aren't people anyway, whatever. And so, you know, and another example, I mean, I recently had a John Wrench from the Institute for Justice on the Libertarian Christian podcast to talk about the 14th Amendment. And one thing we talked about a little bit, you know, you look back at that history and you see state and local governments arguing for the right of the collective to lynch Black individuals without a trial. And you have a federal government saying, no, that's not acceptable. And so then the question is, well, which one of those was more libertarian? The federal government or the subsidiaries that didn't believe in an individual rights or trial rights or, you know, due process rights? And I think that's the sort of the tension is, if you say that all libertarianism is decentralization, you're going to say, well, obviously the localities that were lynching people were more libertarian because they were disobeying the centralized authority. But I think what I would say is, ideally, we want a society that's not centralized, but also a society that respects individual rights. And in this example, just like the North and South Korea example or the Civil War example, it just doesn't work the way that I think the decentralizers want to say that it does. It's more complicated than that. Not that they don't have any insights, but they're, I think, by centering that as libertarianism, I think they're missing the bigger picture.
Yeah, I would agree. I think decentralization is, like, one of those things that's, like, it's generally preferable, but I agree it is one factor. And you can have a local tyranny that is worse than what the federal government is doing, right? Like, Jim Crow was kind of an example of this, right? The civil rights movement was, and, you know, another example of this, right? So I say that reluctantly because I've often struggled with this because I did that thing where, like, you take all the red pills at once when I became a libertarian. I didn't really have my minarchist phase. I just went, you know, full-blown, just like ANCAP, hate the state. And of course, I read Spooner and all that. And I was like, you know, the Constitution's dumb, federalism is bad, just like all this. And as I've matured a bit my libertarianism, I still have, like, those core critiques of those things. But I understand how, like, it's not all black and white. Like, sometimes those things can be good, can be useful, can produce good outcomes, even though I, you know, as you say, like, they are still kind of a rotten tree at the end of the day. But, like, you can say this tree is less rotten than another one. But that's a good segue to one of my concerns, because, like, on one hand, I agree with you that a criticism of what Deist is partly saying, insofar as, you know, he's championing decentralization, yeah, I agree. Like, there's something missing there. But something I agree with him, and it's not that I agree with him and I'm like, yay about it, right? I agree with him because I kind of see it playing out. And it's like, I am, on one hand, despite the, you know, sort of the joke about me being the, you know, the bordertarian of the group, even though I'm not, I'm really the fence sitter of the group. I'm like the illegal immigrant that, like, you know, gets up on the Trump wall and then, like, I can't decide if, you know, Mexico or U.S. looks worse. And that's how I am with the border dispute. Actually, I met up with a friend for lunch today and I told him, you know, he's more on the closed border side. And I was like, listen, the issue is I'm basically just a mirror. If I sit down with an open borders libertarian, I'm going to argue with them. If I sit down with a closed border libertarian, I'm going to argue with them. So it is what it is. But lately on like X, for example, I've been mostly arguing on not even just the open borders side, just arguing on the, we shouldn't lean into the worst parts of nationalism and tribalism and just embrace full-blown ethno-nationalism, which I felt like, you know, 2 years ago, I would never have to be like, you know, raging on social media about this with a bunch of people. And I have to, and it's, you know, been rather disconcerting to me. And on one hand, that's like me keeping my foot in the principles, because at the end of the day, no matter what the world does, I'm not going to defend or adopt, you know, that kind of identity politics that takes these different forms. On the other hand, I'm recognizing that, you know what, like, this is a legitimate hurdle that we as libertarians have to deal with. And when it comes to our pragmatic concerns of how do we approach the equation of trying to create a more free society, it does seem like perhaps there are parts about the sort of like, you know, American experiment and this sort of like, you know, attempt to be a melting pot that's not working out because people are just too different. And at the end of the day, as much as I will waste too much time on social media arguing with people, it doesn't actually like change their minds. And like, I can be as right as I can be, but sometimes people are more motivated by, you know, and it's irrational, but it's still what they're motivated by. They're motivated by their tribalism, by their fear of the unknown. It's a very human thing. It's something we see in the Bible even. And I don't know that it's a certain... So like, what I'm not saying is that we as libertarians should do what some libertarians have done and just go like, fine, we're going to embrace it. But I also don't know that we... It's a problem of like, you know, I think some people are... It's like, you know that analogy, like you attract more bees with vinegar than honey? And like, the problem is like, I don't know that either in this case is working. Like, honey is sort of like adopting the bad ideas. The vinegar is like, well, then we're just like, we're isolating ourselves and we're not making any progress. But it's anyway, all that to say, I find myself very concerned by it, because on one hand, I've generally been on the pro decentralization bandwagon. But now that bandwagon is being hijacked by people who are saying, you know, that it would be good to, you know, send black people back to Africa, and saying that it would be good to. Well, who basically hate Israel, but they hate Israel because Israel does the thing that they want to do, which is create a giant exclusivist ethno state. It's troubling. But I'm kind of at the first times for the first time since I've became a libertarian, really at a loss for like, I really don't know what to do with this. It seems like a giant mess, and society is definitely worse. Either things have gotten worse, or it was worse than I realized, or combination of both.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you talk about the melting pot and whether that's succeeding, I mean, it seems to me that it actually kind of works where it actually exists. It mostly seems scary to people who live in monocultural communities, right? So, like, you know, most people who live in New York City like living in New York City. They like that it's a melting pot. You know, it works for them. It's like people who live in, like, you know, Arkansas. And like in a pretty, you know, pretty uniform community, they get, you know, freaked out about the idea of, you know, drag queen story hour in Portland. And, you know, there is, I think, you know, that's part of it. I think the other part of it is, I think violence, the state always makes things worse, because then it's not, I'm going to live how I want to live. You live how you want to live. We mind our business and, you know, whatever. It becomes, I think the world should be this way, and I'm going to force it to be this way, whether you like it or not. And so I think when you remove violence from the equation, that also, I think, makes the melting pot less scary. Hopefully, is that Visine there you put in your eyes? You're right?
Yeah, let's put an eye drops in. Sorry.
I was like, he just lost his mind, started with the super glue. So
I'm so tired of looking at social media. I'm gluing my eyes shut in protest.
I thought it was that you know, maybe the libertarians are just Republicans who smoke pot and you just needed to. All right. Well, the quote from Deist, it's in his article for A New Libertarian that you've cited to me a few times on this, is he says, blood and soil, and then he adds also God and nation, but we'll focus on the blood and soil part, still matter to people, and that libertarians ignore this at the risk of irrelevance. And he kind of expands on that. He talks about how, you know, libertarians have this tendency to fall into utopianism, and they sort of, he sort of criticizes libertarians of almost talking like progressives, right? That, like, you know, we need to evolve, and then, you know, once we see things the right way, we'll bring about this new age. You know, once we all become Rothbardians or whatever, once we all accept the non-aggression principle and we all become libertarians, then the world will change. And part of that is giving up our, you know, these outdated ethnic nationalist cultural alliances, and we become hyper-individualists. And so part of, you know, Dice's argument is like, well, you know, that's not going to work. That's you know, let's just start with decentralization, because that's something that's more pragmatic, right? And we can almost sort of tap into people's, you know, irrationality and tribalism.
Well, I
to make a more libertarian world.
If I was going to like steel man that position, it would be that forced association and integration doesn't seem to be the path forward. And that, like, what my always said is that if you allow people to freely associate, then the free market, because it relies on free trade and voluntary association, I think that would actually do better towards then creating more social cooperation and then eventual like softening of those lines in society. But that the state, as you said, is bad at everything it does, and because it's the threat of force, it distorts these things. And so I think there's better, but I think, you know, that doesn't work as well when the people setting out to do the decentralization are doing it motivated by protecting their ethnic, you know, protectionism.
So, I mean, the thing is, though, I don't think that, at least as I read this article, I didn't think that Dice is really saying that if we start with decentralization, eventually everybody will get along. I think he sort of acknowledges that, he argues that tribalism is kind of a feature of human nature, and that probably it will remain a feature of human nature. And
that, well, you'll have point, kind of right? I think he says both, right? Because he says that, like, at the beginning, that, like, our values, or he does cite, like, one of our values is social cooperate. We're the people of peace, of social cooperation, of free market, so things like that. And sure, those are things that we want and shouldn't abandon. But also, we have this problem of, like, that, like, people don't seem necessarily geared towards that. So I think he's kind of like I've often said, like, do we make the perfect the enemy of the good, or do we, like, here's something I'm concerned about, which I don't mean to keep cutting you off, but I want to get your thoughts on the things I'm specifically concerned about, which is that sometimes I almost feel like we as libertarians can sound almost like the communists, where we're like, we have to remake man, right? Like, man has to be fundamentally different, and then our system will work. And I'm like, you know, listen, we should oppose, and I know you've seen, like, I oppose, you know, pretty vehemently, you know, anti-Semitism and racism and this sort of rise in tribalism. You know, I think you kind of do have to have, I think you do need to push back hard against its most destructive and, you know, sort of pathological expressions. But then it's like, below that, there is sort of this like baseline in-group preference that I don't know you can, you know, sort of work out of people, or that you necessarily should be the aim. The aim should, like, I would say peaceful decentralization would be the path forward. But anyway, that, and maybe I'm giving Dice to charitable reading, but I think that's kind of his point, is that, like, we're not going to be able to, like of the paths we have available to us, decentralization seems to be the best bet, which I kind of still lean towards agreeing with that. But I do think it kind of depends on, like, the devil's in the details of how you're decentralizing.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, so Dice sort of talks about how, you know, average people don't trust, you know, Washington, D.C. and Brussels and these kind of centralized power structures. And that he argues that we should seize on that. And he says, you know, it's not really our goal to convince other people to become Rothbardians. And he says, you know, I'll quote him exactly here. Is it our goal to convince them all to become thorough Rothbardians? Should libertarians care about gay marriage in Saudi Arabia or insist on the same border arrangements for Brownsville, Texas, and Monaco? Should we agitate for Texas-style open carry laws in France to prevent the next Bataclan? And so ultimately is kind of arguing here. Actually, I'll keep quoting him. Or would our time be better spent making the case for political decentralization, secession, and subsidiarity? In other words, should we let Malta be Maltese? And so that's an end quote there. And so he talks about kind of rejecting a kind of a universalistic libertarianism that says we're going to sort of center the non-aggression principle. And he says what we really should be focusing on is decentralization. And so if, you know, Saudi Arabia doesn't want to give gay people rights, well, that's Saudi Arabia's business, you know? Now, Rothbard, I think, gets a little bit closer to what you're saying. You know, when Rothbard talks about nationalism, he sort of imagines that he sort of sees the state propping up nationalism as it currently exists. And he argues that, you know, if you get rid of the state, you're probably going to have a lot of little sort of nations, right? Little communities where they sort of have something that they agree on, kind of a unified culture, unified political viewpoint. And so then that's still kind of tribalism, but it's on a much smaller scale. And that gets us closer maybe to individualism. And so, you know, when I look at, you know, like what Deist is arguing, I think part of what he's saying is that libertarianism should be paired with like Thomas Sowell's constrained vision of humanity, right? So Thomas Sowell argues that the left and the right have these two different visions, that the right sees human beings as fallible and irrational and sort of immoral, at least to a point. And so we can't expect utopia with human beings. Whereas the left has an unconstrained vision of humanity that basically means that, you know, right, they can be not just optimists, but really utopians. And so Deist rejects that. He says, well, yeah, like you said, that's kind of a Marxist viewpoint. We can't make everybody perfect. And so, you know,
and I would say that's a Christian viewpoint too, right? Like we as Christians don't think that, you know, especially on this side of the second coming, that, you know, we're ever going to have a, you know, a society where people aren't under the influence of some kind of, you know, depravity, whether you believe that's total or
half. Well, yeah, the Reformed believe it more than others, but yeah, but it's certainly the idea of human fallibility and human sin and corruption, right, is there, right? And I think I largely agree with him on some of those points, at least on the constrained vision stuff. But I do think that you need some significant buy-in if you really want to create something like a libertarian society. So even to just get to decentralization, that requires a significant change in the way people are currently thinking. And so, you know, and I think people do have to change somewhat, but we can't expect them to be perfect. But I think there is sort of a buy-in into libertarianism that has to happen. And so, you know, like, you know, libertarians, I think, well, like, so here, I might kind of point to the Christian nationalist stuff, because the argument he's making here is not that different from like what Stephen Wolf would say, right? So he says, you know, people are emotionally tethered to the land they grew up in, ergo nationalism. But I feel like that's saying you love your wife, ergo you should love every woman with your wife's skin color. And to me, like, you can't get nationalism, which really requires a state to be stable, from the fact that you get a warm, fuzzy feeling when you get home from a vacation, right? So what I've sort of argued before is, you know, guys like Stephen Wolf are starting with an observation. It's really kind of more of a localistic assumption, and not even that, because you can have attachments to different places. You know, you might say, you know, I spent the summer in Oregon with my grandparents, and that place is also special to me, right? Or in another country, even.
I have an attachment to Baltimore, not because I grew up there, but because my dad grew up there, and like the sports teams I always rooted for were from there. And I have like, I even kind of, it's like a love-hate thing. Like, it's become a really dangerous and kind of crappy place to live, but I have this kind of fondness and affection for it, even though I don't actually live there. I don't have that much in common with people that live there, other than I, you know, root for the same sports teams generally.
Yeah. Well, it's more complex than that, right? And so for someone like Stephen Wolf, there's a bit of a disingenuousness there in saying, like, you know, because you have a warm, fuzzy feeling about a place you have a close association with or something, that means we should keep Mexicans out.
Like, it's also self-defeating. The way I've always said it is that if people have these natural like preferences, then they'll just organize based on those preferences. You wouldn't need violence to, like, if it's natural, it doesn't need violence. If it's violence, if you need violence to make it happen, then it's not natural. You can't really have it both ways. Like, it's natural and we need violence to make it happen. Like, that doesn't really hold up to much logical scrutiny.
And it's like, you know, what is it to be an American, right? I mean, this is an enormous land and it's very diverse. And, you know, prior to, you know, quick travel, you know, interstate travel and stuff like that, like, you know, you probably wouldn't go very far from, you know, where you were born, right? And so, like, you know, we call the construction worker in Alabama and the movie star in Los Angeles Americans. We say they have the same culture and values. Like, do they? I mean, do I have more in common with an atheist Marxist in Oregon than I do with a Christian libertarian in Canada? And so, you know, it's identity is more complicated than to sort of say, you know, you like your house, therefore let's be nationalists. And so, you know, so there's another article that we've discussed a little bit that you had mentioned to me, Nations by Consent, by the kind of later Murray Rothbard, I think that was in 94. And
it was like the last thing he wrote, I think, like one of the
it feels kind of like later paleo Rothbard than like kind of earlier Rothbard did. But like, yeah, so when you read Anatomy of the State, and he talks about how like in the Middle Ages, you'd have people living and loving and trading across borders. And even the two countries that might have been at war with each other, he said nobody cared what their kings were doing. They didn't feel any loyalty to their kings, right? And so, you know, what they sort of said was, if you lived in a border town, the people who are closest to you were not necessarily your countrymen, right? And so you would have a connection with them because you worked with them, because you lived with them or whatever. And so you didn't really care what your kings thought about that. And there's a little piece of that, I think, still in Nations by Consent. Rothbard writes, "It is absurd to designate every nation state with its self-proclaimed boundary as it exists at any one time as somehow right and sacrosanct, each with its territorial integrity to remain as spotless and unbreached as your or my bodily person or private property." Well, that sounds great. I love that. That's peak libertarian kind of anti-nationalism, right? And so what he's essentially saying is that the lines that constituted a nation 50 years ago might not constitute it today. And it's really because of two fundamental realities. One is something he'd mentioned earlier, which is people ignore imaginary lines if they can, if it's more convenient for them to. They don't really care about that stuff. And the second thing is that states really expand and contract as fortunes change. And that's due to, you know, violence and so on and so forth. And so that's why I would argue, you know, that a sort of cosmopolitan viewpoint is more consistent with libertarianism than kind of a populist or nationalistic one. And
well, I think I've said this to you before in our private chats. I tend to agree. And so again, I'm kind of two minds because I actually would prefer the more cosmopolitan approach to things. But I think the problem is like your mileage varies based upon where you live. Like where I live is actually kind of like, it's kind of a weird amalgamation because there's parts of where I live that are very like the most diehard of diehard MAGA types. And then there's also, you know, a bunch of people with the rainbow flags out there. And it's caused actually a lot of tension, you know, where I live, right? Because you have these kind of like, you know, it's people who've lived here for a long time, people who are moving here from Maryland and other cities. And that creates a lot of chaos. And it's not, you know, it's the ugly side of an attempt at something like pluralism or cosmopolitanism, right? And it's like, it doesn't change the underlying theory, right? Which I think that's part of what some people are getting wrong. And like they notice in real time where there's a breakdown in people's ability to tolerate different lifestyles and cultures and to get along with them, to want to live alongside them. And so that can lead you to the conclusion of like, well, then what is right is that everyone should live as separated and itemized as possible in their own little tribes. And I don't think that is like, again, I don't think that is maybe an impulse and a temptation that exists within human nature, but I don't think it is like moral or like the normative thing that we should play into. But I do think we should be wary of it, that there's good and bad ways to push against that, I guess is my point. And I do wonder, like, and this is to tie it into the immigration stuff. I do wonder, like, is whatever the path forward is, if we're trying to create a freer society, like, does that step one, I've asked this, I think, for a while now, does that step one have to be that America becomes a republic again, as limited as possible? And that might mean, like, perhaps at this point in history is the way things are pushing, and we might need to have some pushback, right, to kind of course correct it, but we might still end up at this moment in history where, for better or worse, and I think there are things that are better about this, right? We become more isolationist where we bring troops home. We're not as involved in the world, but not all that's motivating that is just like a, we hate war and we're pro peace. Some of it is, you know, sort of a tribalism, but I don't know. Like, I don't know. And this gets into stuff that we don't have the time. It isn't completely germane, you know, the actual immigration debate and stuff like that. And coincidentally, I think in a couple of weeks, Doug and I are going to go watch the debate between Dave Smith and Alex. I can't pronounce his last name. Norwa something.
Sounds like an immigrant if you can't pronounce his last name. I wonder what position exactly he's going to pick.
But he works for Cato. So you can, I don't know how many Alexes work at Cato.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about, but I can't remember his last name either.
Yeah,
I know
but they're going to have a debate over this. And I, you know, it's one of those things where, again, I think this is an incredibly complex problem in terms of, like, we don't want to confuse libertarianism with ethno-nationalism and, like, tell ethno-nationalists that, like, we're happy for them to continue being ethno-nationalists. And I don't do that, right? Like, I don't mince words with them and or anything like that. But I also don't know that then the solution is to say, not only can you not be an ethno-nationalist, but, like, you know, you have no choice but to accept my position that, like, the only morally correct position we can have right now is to have complete open borders, and you can't have any qualms about that. To some extent, and maybe I'm, you know, I could be wrong on this, I could be persuaded against this, I think to some extent, this is a tiny blowback. Not that it's all from this, but that to the extent that the elites and whatnot have overtly and covertly pushed a system of this sort of, like what I said at the beginning in the intro, this sort of bomb the world, invite the world agenda, I think what we're witnessing is somewhat of a blowback to that. And not that I even agree, like, listen, just like I can say, you know, October 7th was blowback for Israel's treatment of Gaza, I don't agree with what Hamas did October 7th, right? Russia invading Ukraine in 2022, 21, I forget the date, it's been a while. But, you know, that invasion was blowback for NATO and American and Ukrainian policy going back decades. I don't agree with Russia invading Ukraine. It was wrong. It's kind of the same thing here. Like, this is, you know, people have agency, but it's also, you know, it's always nature and nurture, and people are somewhat going to, you know, act out their incentives and what's going around them. And I think we do see some blowback where people are kind of tired of this, and they kind of see it as, we need to just, like, retreat back in, become a nation again, just a you know, a smaller public that governs ourselves and cares about ourselves, and we're not going to go around the world and, you know, dominate, but we're not going to just let everyone else come here at the same time, and, like, we just need to focus on ourselves. So yeah, that's for better or worse where we're at. And I kind of feel like both sides of the movement right now are reacting to that in ways that I'm kind of, like, not able to get on board with.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if people who have a sort of an anti-immigration posture, that's largely because of the way the state has done it. Like, you brought up a term earlier, like a forced sort of, looking, what was the term?
Integration.
Forced integration. There's another term.
Integration.
Yeah, well, there's forced integration, but there's another term too, where it's like, you know, people have to kind of consent to interact with each other, but it's like a forced, anyway. And that's kind of one of those, I feel like, sort of a slippery word, right? Because, like, if what you're saying is, you know, hey, if you're a Christian baker, you have to bake a cake for gay people, you know, that's this kind of forced interaction that people, that really nobody wants, you know? And
you, like, hate me, that. Bake a cake for me.
right, exactly. But what some people mean by that is, like, I don't want to have to cross the street and see a Mexican on the sidewalk. And, like, you know, like, that's, if that's what you mean by forced integration, that you might have to look at somebody.
I always ask, it's like, you ever get Mexican food from a white person? It usually sucks.
100% it does. Yeah. Yeah. Velveeta cheese instead of nacho cheese. So I'm not sure if the anti-immigration sentiment is really based in largely what the state has done. The reason I say that, like, people talk about kind of, like, oh, well, they get welfare. And it's like, well, not generally. like there are certain things that they can sort of get and certain they can advantage of certain, you know, programs or whatever. But if you're not really a citizen, you don't have access to the same benefits, right? But people sort of think that that happens, right? Because they kind of want to believe it. And so the immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, not very far from where I'm at, right? It's a large, largely Haitians who are coming in.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a government funded thing. And it was kind of dumb in the sense that they brought over a lot of people and put them in one place. Right. And so like, it was harder for them to sort of integrate into society. So like, you can kind of say like, okay, well, that was a dumb government thing. But largely what people that I know from Springfield and people who've talked to people in Springfield, the people who are kind of there already, like one of the things they'll complain about is like, well, a lot of them are driving without driver's licenses and that's not great. But like, apart from that, like there's not the hostility that you would think was there based on, Trump going out in the debate stage and saying they're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats.
Yeah.
That wasn't really the way people in Springfield felt about it.
I do wonder though, like for every example of that, and this is tough because like, I'm not there. I haven't been there, right? As the saying goes. But you do hear stories about stuff in Europe with the massive influx of Muslim immigrants, and this is this tough thing where like I don't want to make the ethno-nationalist point for them because they have this very like deterministic view of race and culture and whatnot, which I think is unscientific, unchristian, and hateful and bigoted. But I also think it'd be naive to say that people from different, countries and cultures that often, I think it's more just a like, it's a correlation, right? Their skin color and race happen to be different, but it's not like baked into their genetics that they have this culture or this mindset. But like, it's just, they will have different values. And so I think that the issue for a lot of people is that they see the state inviting people in and then saying, we're all part of this democratic system. But then that's going to create this kind of like moral political hazard where we don't all have the same values. And I do think that is one of the more at least legitimate concerns about the open borders program is like if we bring so many people here from different places that have different values than us. And I know that you can't just come here and automatically vote, but there is such things as voter fraud and people having children here and then those children become citizens and they vote. And so it's not as like, there's a cartoonish version of this argument that I think is kind of silly, but I think there is a legitimate concern there that maybe doesn't happen as instantaneously as some people make it out to be, but it does create some concerns about like, is what it means to be an American is, the people caring about the Constitution and adhering to, an originalist interpretation of it and, believing in the Bill of Rights and all this stuff. Like, is that going to be preserved if we have open borders and all these people coming here and whatnot, especially as we're, it's not just like we open the borders and then see what happens. It does seem, even to me, that both intentionally and unintentionally, the state is sort of ramping up that process, right? Like it's not totally just like a free market, like millions of people just decided at once to like, come here. A lot of them are sadly refugees and either from war-torn countries or countries where, there's been complete political destabilization and whatnot. And I strongly hate the dehumanization of a lot of these people. And this sort of like blanket, like, yeah, there are some gang members and some criminals and whatnot in that calculus. But people tend to play, especially, ICE and the law enforcement right now are playing rather fast and loose with actually, they're not even playing fast and loose with making the determinations. They're just not making determinations because they said, well, due process, what's that? Right. So,
right. Well, that's the irony, right? They're going to come here and they're going to change our values and they're not going to believe the Constitution. Yeah. So let's throw away the Constitution.
Right. No, the irony is not lost on me, which is why I'm simultaneously raging against both sides because I'm just like, it's like that Family Guy meme where it's like, kids, you just, right. You're both awful.
or I thought of the Muhammad Ali thing about, he wasn't going to go fight the Viet Cong because the Viet Cong never called him the N-word. It's like, Mexican never tried to take away my freedom. You do. And so,
right.
Yeah, I will say there is something different going on in Europe because Europe really is a welfare state. And I think when you look at, you know, this history of immigration, when people say we're a nation of immigrants and the melting pot, there's really something to that. And, you know, we don't think about it much because we focus kind of more on the first generation, the people who come here, maybe don't speak great English or whatever. And we kind of ignore the fact that we're all mutts, right? And so, you know, I think we have this sort of history of people coming here and getting it and getting the American dream and understanding it and having to stand up on their own two feet, which means they have to get along with their neighbors. They have to work in their communities where they live. And I think what Europe allows is, you know, this kind of ghettoization where you can sort of come here and just take money and never really become integrated into society in any meaningful way. And so, yeah, I think there are some real dangers in Europe, you know, and as far as like the voting thing, like obviously as anarchists and libertarians, we would sort of say, yeah, you know, well, maybe you shouldn't let people's freedom be decided by votes. and that's part one. But then also like too, like this is like always like just kind of amazed me a little bit when people on the right are like saying, oh, they're trying to sneak Mexicans over here and immigrants so they can, because they'll vote for them. It's like, well, why will they vote for them? It's like, well, because they don't, you know, they're not racist. And it's like, well, you know, a lot of these people from Cuba are conservative. A lot of people coming from like, you know, sort of more like Muslim countries even.
Oh, yeah. There was a big turnout of Hispanics and Puerto Ricans, right. And other, yeah, for Trump.
For Trump.
So right. It
and that amazed me because, I mean, he was pretty hardcore. Like yeah. I felt like if anybody's not going to vote for this guy, it's got to be like Hispanics, right? And but
there's Stockholm syndrome going on there.
Yeah. Well, I've got a few friends who are kind of, you know, second, third generation immigrants, and they're very anti illegals, right? They sort of have a sense of, you know, like I got in here the right way, or my grandparents did, or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
To me, the right is telling on themselves a little bit. Like when they say, like, there's all these people who come in who have these conservative values who should be voting for us, but they're not. They're voting for the other party. Well, why is that? You know, like these are people
because they're not white, Cody. No, I mean, but like literally, there's people saying that, and I'm just like I don't know. Again, and we should wrap up here, but like it's like I feel like I'm getting punked. I'm like because I've for years been saying, you know, I'm a '90s kid. I'm like, yeah, racism's a thing of the past, and then it's just like, you know, then all of a sudden it's just like the right wing said, hold on, hold my beer. You think racism is a thing of the past? Like. Why, you know, I'm toying around making the title of this episode provocatively, like making racism great again. Like that almost seems to be what the theme is lately. But yeah. Cody, I want to give you, so we're short on time. I'm going to give you the last word here just to kind of like, you know, land us and give us your final kind of take on just like what you think, you know, like as libertarians, as Christians, you know, how do we stay grounded as we're, you know, continuing to kind of like unpack and dissect all these different threads and trying not to get, you know, too lost in the craziness, try to make it as simple as you can for us. Right.
Yeah. One of the things we thought we were maybe going to talk about tonight, but we've run out of time a little bit, is the Shiloh Hendricks thing. The lady at the park who was screaming the N-word at a child and was able to crowdfund all this money from supporters. And, you know, I don't think we can leverage that. As libertarians, I think that libertarianism is actually opposed to that kind of thing. And in particular, when I say that kind of thing, I mean identity politics. And what the Shiloh Hendricks thing tells me, and this was not long after there was another situation where a black kid stabbed a white kid and then his family crowdfunded from, you know, other people, probably not the same people, I would imagine, who crowdfunded Shiloh Hendricks. But what that tells me is that We're in a time right now where I think identity politics has largely replaced whatever principles and policy were part of the left and right traditionally, right? And what I would say is we should not be doing that. Like to me, libertarianism is kind of this third way that's not really concerned about identity politics. We're concerned about individuals, and we're concerned.
I think we're concerned insofar as we should be actively against.
This shouldn't be part of our wiring to think in these terms. Like libertarianism is kind of universalistic and it's also kind of individualistic, but it's not really as collectivistic. That's that kind of identity politics stuff you get on the left and the right.
Yep.
And I don't think we should play into that. I think we should present ourselves as an alternative and say, aren't you sick of this? Like, is this how you want to do this? Is this how you want to live? Is this, you want to spend every day angry that, you know, that somewhere, you know, 12 states over, there might be a, you know, drag queen story hour? Like, just, you know, I would like to think that we can actually present a meaningful alternative to people. And maybe that means, you know, if you still want to join an Amish community, because you know, that's just where your values are or whatever. Okay, fine, sure. But like, you know, if you're sick of identity politics like I am, I think what you do is you look at libertarianism, you think it through, you take the ideas seriously, and you apply them.
Yeah.
And then
after that, you go to libertarianchristians.com/donate. You make sure you're subscribed to the Biblical Anarchy podcast, to Libertarian Christians podcast, all our podcasts. And in all seriousness, I do hope that even conversations like this are part of showing people that there's a better way. That like, we can meet people where they're at and go, listen, I get it. The world can be scary. There's things going on that are outside of your control, but you know, especially as Christians, right? We can talk about libertarian politics, but especially as Christians, like if you read the entire Bible and you come away thinking that like what Christ really wants you to do is to go create, you know, a giant white ethno state, I would encourage you to like, I don't know what translation you're using, but find a better translation and reread it and come back to me. Cody,
it's that Trump Bible, Jacob.
Oh gosh, yeah. My pastor, as a joke, got me one of those founders' Bibles.
Cool.
Cody, I appreciate you coming on. It's a blast as always. I would love to do it again sometime. People can, of course, follow you at the Libertarian Christians podcast because you co-host there. What's your handle again on X and social media? People can find you on, you know, Facebook and Instagram and all that.
Yeah. So if you're watching it, I copied you and I put my Twitter handle in my my little name there. So it's at Cantus Firmus CC, CantusFirmusCC. So you can find me there on Twitter.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks everybody for tuning in and listening. As I always conclude by saying, live at peace, live for Christ. Take care. Talk to you next time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you liked today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.
Hello everyone, it's Doug from the Libertarian Christian Podcast. You might notice already that this recording sounds quite a bit different from usual. In fact, it probably sounds pretty crappy. Well, I'm doing this to show you something pretty amazing. As you might know, the guys over at Podsworth Media have been producing my show for several years, quite a while, hundreds of episodes. And now they have a brand new online app for taking rough recordings like this one and making them sound a whole lot cleaner and a lot more listenable in just a few easy clicks. So here are some of the core features. They remove background noise. It reduces plosives, which is really handy for me because I often forget to put my pop filter on before I do a YouTube video. Because pop filters look terrible when you're on camera. It fixes clipping. It removes clicks and pops. It evenly levels dialogue so that you don't have somebody talking really quietly. And then somebody talking really loud because they're too close to the mic or too far away from the mic. How do you use it? It's easy. You go to podsworth.com, you click get started. And because you're a listener to one of the Libertarian Christian Institute's podcasts, you can get 50% off your first order by entering the promo code LCI50. That's LCI50. And you will get 50% off your first order. If you are doing anything like a podcast, a video, a sermon, an audiobook, anything that's spoken word, you want to use podsworth.com and clean up your audio to be even more professional and polished. You want to use podsworth.com and clean up your audio to be even more professional and polished.